It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Later in the program, we're looking at the Freedom Summer of 1964, 50 years later, through the eyes of a woman who lost her son in the civil rights struggle. But first, we wanted to talk about what was happening in Pittsburgh in the summer of 1964, what the civil rights struggle looked like right here. Community College of Allegheny County professor Ralph Proctor has just released his latest book. It's called Voices from the Firing Line, a personal account of the Pittsburgh civil rights movement. He joins us here in Studio A. Ralph Proctor, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you very much.
You can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. We'd especially like to hear from you if you were living in Pittsburgh in 1964. What are the ways in which you remember segregation in Pittsburgh manifesting, and what civil rights leaders were doing to speak out? 412-246-2002, the number to call. Email ESSPGH at WESA.FM. On Twitter, ESSPGH, hashtag EPLive. Ralph Proctor, we hear an awful lot about what was happening in the South during the Freedom Summer of 1964, but sadly, conditions for African Americans in the Steel City weren't exactly the best back then. What do you remember about segregation in Pittsburgh 50 years ago?
Well, I remember that Pittsburgh was a segregated society. There was one society, black, one society, white, separate and unequal. Bird Brown, who was the leader of the NAACP and the United Negro Protest Committee, said to me one day, if you're a conscious black person, you cannot live for one day in Pittsburgh without being acutely aware of the overwhelming sense of prejudice and racism in this city. For example, there were restaurants downtown in which black folks could not eat, Stouffer's, Brashwell's. You could not eat in any of the five and dime stores, and there were four of them, downtown Pittsburgh, Kresge's, McCrory's, and two Murphy's, G.C. Murphy's. And if a black person approached the counter and chose to order some food, a Coke, a drink, a sandwich, they were met at the takeout counter and handed their food in a brown paper bag. The implication is obvious. Take your food and get away from here. Don't bother sitting down. Every restaurant that I could think of outside was segregated. Blacks had to sit in peanut heaven in the theaters in downtown Pittsburgh.
In the in the balconies.
In the balcony. Yep. Peanut heaven is usually the second balcony. If there's only one, then we only had to go up one flight. But that was true all over Pittsburgh. Swimming. Black folks could not swim in Holland Park. There were two pools in North Park. One was called Sully's or Scully's. I'm forgetting now. We could swim in that, but we could not swim in the other. There was one swimming pool in North Park. We weren't permitted to swim in that. We had to sue the city of Pittsburgh in order to be allowed to swim in a park, in the public park, Holland Park. Kennywood Park had a swimming pool. We sued them and got the right for black folks to swim in it. Before one black toe ever got into that water, they destroyed the pool. They paved it over, closed it down to make sure black folks could not get in there. In every aspect of life, Pittsburgh was segregated, was racist, was exceedingly unpleasant for black folks.
The South was the place that had the Jim Crow laws,
right.
Yet segregation proliferated here, and Pittsburgh was not the only northern city where this was happening. But the question is, why was it happening, and why was it happening in Pittsburgh, which had after the Great Migration, mm-hmm. a fairly large and prominent African-American population?
Absolutely. My theory is that Pittsburgh is one of the closest northern cities to the South. If you cross over the Mason-Dixon line, you come into Pittsburgh. You're right across the border from West Virginia. And, you know, if you go to Midland, PA, and other small towns outside of Pittsburgh, you're right next to West Virginia. So my theory is that many of the folks who lived in Pittsburgh had their roots in the South. And Pittsburgh also had old money, and old money precluded black folks being included in that. You found the same kind of thing in Cincinnati, Ohio, right over the border from the South. In any of the border states, you found black folks being treated as if it was the southern part of the United States. And while it is true that down south they had Jim Crow laws, in Pittsburgh they had Jim Crow customs that were enforced as if they were laws. For example, when I was going to the University of Pittsburgh, I was visiting my mother, and I told her I had a meeting. I was going to have lunch. And she said, where? And I said, oh, Cicero's. And she said, Cicero's on Forbes? I said, yeah. She said, in Oakland? I said, yes, ma'am. She said, you know they don't allow colored people there. And I said, well, Mom, I'm going to leave a check for you, fully signed. You just fill in the part where the money is, because you're going to have to bail me out of jail if they don't sell me, if they don't serve me. And that's the way Pittsburgh was.
And what happened?
Nobody bothered me, fortunately, so I didn't go to jail, at least not that time.
So there were, you know, it could change probably, though not likely and not often, it could conceivably change from hour to hour depending on who was at the counter or, you know, which owner was in charge of which establishment.
Mm-hmm.
So there weren't laws per se, but why weren't the laws being enforced? Who was in charge of, I think, was it Mayor Barr back then?
It was Mayor Barr. He simply did not think black folks were equal. Caleb Irvis, who was the Speaker of the House, known as the Lion of the House, threatened the mayor with picketing downtown. And the mayor told him, all right, you win. When Caleb pointed out the window to a busload of picketers waiting to picket Kaufman's department store, he said, you'll win, but you'll never rise to any place of prominence. Caleb proved him wrong, but people were threatened. And what people don't understand about Pittsburgh is there was violence here as well as in the South. There was a march across the Manchester Bridge, for example, to protest the construction of Three Rivers Stadium. The police met the marchers, and many of the police did not have badges on, and those who had badges had some sort of tape or cloth over to obscure their numbers, and they met the marchers in full force, unarmed marchers, and beat them and maced them. And some of my friends, I was not there, but some of my friends said, I thought I was going to die. I thought they were going to throw me into the river. When they were protesting the construction of the U.S. Steel building, the gentlemen who were working on the project would climb into the rafters before the demonstrators got there and try to urinate on the demonstrators, throw hot rivets down, throw pennies down, Bird Brown's boat was blown out of the water. Another friend of mine, Lloyd Bell, Dr. Lloyd Bell, had his car tampered with during a demonstration. People were beaten, as a matter of fact. We spent some time in jail. Pittsburgh was not as safe as people would like to believe. Violence was not confined to the southern part of the United States.
We are talking with Ralph Proctor, who, again, is the author of a book, his latest book, Voices from the Firing Line, a personal account of the Pittsburgh civil rights movement, talking about what was happening here in the 60s. You can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. When you mentioned the protests of the building of Three Rivers Stadium and the U.S. Steel building, what the protests were about was not necessarily the building of those structures, but the fact that blacks were not included, were not being given an equal percentage of the construction jobs associated with those projects.
Yeah. We had been promised 25%, and we never on any project that I know of came anywhere near 25%. Never. And even when some places said, well, we have 25%, it was a lie, because what they would do was they would hire some shills who had black skin and give them money, and then those shills were supposed to hire other folks, and the folks that they hire would be white. So we'd wind up with maybe 5% in the city of Pittsburgh. So though there were no laws about segregation, people simply did it. No one said to you, we don't hire colored people for this job. But when you went for an interview, they would put two little red X's in the upper right-hand corner, which said, this is a colored person. don't hire.
Your book is called A Personal Account of the Civil Rights Movement. Describe the aspects of the things that you were involved with personally when it came to the Pittsburgh Civil Rights Movement. What were some of the experiences, Ralph, that you had?
When I came out of the service, I joined a very active young adult chapter of the NAACP. And I immediately got into trouble because I was full of myself, quite frankly. And I kept picking at the guy who was the president of the young adult chapter, always disrupting the meeting. And Dorothy K. Williams, who was the leader, said to me one day, Ralph, with all that energy, you're a Pitt student. Why don't you go over to Pitt and start your own chapter, and maybe you'll quit messing with the guy who's the president here. It was Coop Ivey. And so I did. Started a chapter of the NAACP at the University of Pittsburgh. Participated in marches, demonstrations, negotiations, everything that was being done. And the problem is people don't know who was here. They don't know about Alma Fox. Alma Speed Fox, the mother of the civil rights movement in Pittsburgh, Bird Brown, the leader, Jim McCoy. I could go on and on and on about the people, and their names have been lost. And the reason I wrote this book was I made a promise to some of them that before I died, I was going to put their names in a place where it would last, and then future researchers, anybody who wanted to know, could pick up the book. And I'll be giving tapes to Carnegie Mellon University, all the original videos that I did of 50 of the people in the movement, and they'll be there for future research. So I've been – also was the first black producer of Black Horizons on WQED, did several shows on WAMO and WPGH. I was first black assistant dean in the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Pittsburgh, first black public relations director for H.J. Hines Corporation. And, you know, I don't take credit for them. I just happened to be in the right place at the right time. And it was not hard to be the first black in those days because folks didn't hire black people.
When did you sense – well, I'll tell you what, I'm going to hold that question because we've got some people on the phone line who want to get through. Let's go to Michael in Penn Hills. Michael, you are on with Dr. Ralph Proctor.
Hello, yes. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, we hear you just fine.
Okay, thank you. I just have a brief comment because I clearly agree and understand the comment that was made about the racism in Pittsburgh and its roots being the fact that we're so close to the South and Mason-Dixon line. But I'll quickly add a comment that I grew up in the Brushton section of the city right there in Homewood and did not move from there until 1970 when I was already 20 years old. So I was literally the only white kid. I was to go to Westinghouse High School, all those different issues that I was surrounded with. But I would just make a comment and ask for you guys to discuss it a bit, that I think the lion's share of the racism, and I lived it, was based on the fact that certainly in Homewood, the Italian-Americans were very fearful of the black people only in the sense that their territory, their area, was kind of being usurped and taken from them. And there was a lot of hatred and anger about that, and it was basically economic, which then, you know, overrode into culturalism, et cetera. So I just ask you to place some comments and thoughts all over the city. You know, the Polish, all the different groups of people felt that racism issue was real. So could you discuss that, please?
Sure.
Yeah. Thank you, Michael, for the call. There's, you know, what Michael's saying certainly rings true, but at the same time, there was a documentary on the station you've done work for, WQED, mm-hmm. which talked about the Westinghouse High School and the area around there, which mm-hmm. was predominantly Italian-Americans and African-Americans. By most accounts, at least in that particular documentary, people got along quite well in that area.
Well, there were pockets. If you went to the Lower Hill, where the Civic Arena finally grew up, you would find that was sort of a little United Nations. Folks got along, whether they were Italian, whether they're German, whether they were Jewish, no matter what, they got along. They lived in close proximity. My father worked for a Jewish guy who owned a grocery store. Certainly there was no racism, no prejudice there. Urban renewal destroyed that community and sent people scurrying into their own individual enclaves. that more than anything else increased racism in the city of Pittsburgh. The gentleman is right about somewhat right about Homewood, that was largely an Italian community. And initially, folks seemed to get along pretty well until urban renewal destroyed the hill. And then the same guy, Robert Pease, did his job on East Liberty. And then folks started moving into Homewood and looking for homes. And what folks don't understand, there were a bunch of realtors who were operating and did a thing that we call blockbusting. They would go into a community that was solid, like Homewood, and they would start saying, you know they're coming, meaning the Negroes. They're coming, and you know the property values are going to go down as soon as the Negroes come in here. And they would hoodwink some person to sell their home at more than it was worth in order to create a vacancy. And then they would hire actors, believe it or not, to come in and pretend that they were going to buy the house. And they would yell and scream and make all kinds of derogatory remarks. And then those realtors would go around and say, you see, they are coming. And you see what kind of people are going to move in. Then they would force the neighbors to sell at less than the value of the house because they knew they had pent up desire for housing as a result of the black folks who got displaced during urban renewal. So blockbusting turned communities from white to black overnight. I saw the same thing happen in Wilkinsburg. The same thing happened in Penn Hills.
412-246-2002, the number to call. Let's go to Margaret in Sheridan, who would like to share a story with us. Margaret, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you.
You're on with Dr. Ralph Proctor. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. Thank you very much for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I wanted to say that in 1963, I was a student going into my senior year at Oliver High School on the north side, and Sears and Roebuck's was on the north side. And in 1963, Sears decided, so up until that time, Sears only had black people in housekeeping, and I think there was one black man who sold men's suits at night, not in the daytime, only at night he was on duty. Other than that, Sears didn't, they had a policy of not hiring black people. So Sears and Roebuck's on the north side reached out to the school board for black seniors for part-time jobs. They wanted to try us out to see to integrate Sears and Roebuck's in Pittsburgh. They were ready to integrate their store personnel. And so they reached out to the high schools through the Board of Education, and they told them they had very specific criteria on what kind of black students they would hire part-time seniors in the stores. They wanted to try out some blacks, and they went to the schools. Okay, however that process went, the counselors were in charge, so I got selected. I got hired. Sears and Roebuck's on the north side in the fall of 1963 brought me in, and they put me in behind the candy counter and at night. From 5 to 9, I had that little part-time job. I was for $30 a week. And so they thought that was a good idea, and I did. I was delighted. I mean, and so, like, I guess you can't say I was the first black person working in Sears and Roebuck's, but because they did have black people scrubbing the floors and cleaning the bathrooms, and they had this one guy at night who was in the men's department, and that was it. So then here I come, they put me in candy. Well, they had to take me out of candy because the white people didn't want my hands in the candy that I, you know, that they had to eat. You know what I'm saying?
Did people complain?
So they had to put me in gift wraps, so they did. But here's what
did
I
people,
wanted to
well,
say.
Yeah, go ahead, Margaret.
At the end, when I graduated the following spring, when it came time for graduation in 1964, which is the period of Mr. Proctor's book there, when it came time for graduation, there was a job posted upstairs in the lunchroom at Sears and Roebuck's on the north side for a clerk typist in the accounting department. And I graduated from Oliver with the business skills degree. I could, you know, I could do shorthand, 100 words a minute. I was typing crazy.
Yeah, they used to teach those things in high school, didn't they, Margaret?
I'm sorry?
They used to teach those things in high school.
Exactly. They had taught me to be a clerk typist. Mm-hmm. Even though I tried at Oliver High School, I applied for Latin because I wanted to go to college to be an English teacher. Ultimately, I did graduate from Purdue University, but I was told by the counselor I was not college material and I was not permitted to get into the college track, and they wouldn't let me take a foreign language because you had to have that to get in college.
Mm-hmm.
They would not, at Oliver High School, they would not let me take French or Latin. They said I was clerical, and they shoved me into the clerical track, and they would not permit me to be on the college track because the counselor people said I was not college material.
Mm-hmm.
Well, anyhow, that's another story.
Well, I'm sorry that happened to you, and I'm guessing, Ralph, that that's not an altogether uncommon story.
And that is not altogether uncommon. It was very commonplace for black youngsters, even me, even me. So it's not uncommon. I was told I was not college material, that I had to go in trade school, Conley trade school specifically, and learn to work with my hands because I wasn't college material, and I was a straight A student. But it was not uncommon at all for the counselors to steer black kids into the trades and away from college. I can name several of the counselors who did that constantly. So her story rings very true, and her story rings very true in terms of people complaining about not wanting her to touch the candy because Isley's told Bird Brown that they didn't want black folks to serve ice cream because our hair broke off, fell into the ice cream, and melted the ice cream. The people who ran the stores,
wow,
the shoe stores on Fifth Avenue, didn't want to hire black boys for selling shoes because they might be handling white women's feet and looking up their dresses. So that is not uncommon at all.
We're just about to time for this segment, and what we've been talking about along with all of these sad stories is the idea that the black community in Pittsburgh galvanized, that they protested. And while 50 years later, things are certainly not where they should be, I think everybody would agree on that. Was there a time when you sensed that all of the efforts of the civil rights, of the people in the civil rights movement, were starting to pay off? Was there a time where you could sense that there was a shift and things were finally starting to go in, if not the perfect right direction, a better direction?
A better direction, most certainly. I saw black people in jobs where I never saw black people before. I saw black people employed in banks and department stores. It did change. I saw blacks on the Pittsburgh Steelers, blacks on the Pittsburgh Pirates. It did change. It's not yet perfect. And I see some of the progress we made going by the wayside as racism, overt racism, is becoming more and more popular in this nation.
The book, again, is A Personal Account of the Civil Rights Movement by Ralph Proctor, and the book is available now. It's the latest book by Ralph Proctor, and let me get the title right. It's Voices from the Firing Line, A Personal Account of the Pittsburgh Civil Rights Movement. And Dr. Proctor, thank you so much for joining us. We know you have a class to teach at CCAC, so we'll let you get on to that, but thank you for being with us here on Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, a conversation with Brad Herzog, co-author of a book with Carolyn Goodman, mother of slain civil rights worker Andrew Goodman. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.